Ben Vera every single Saturday night, early Sunday morning, midnight to 2 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, right before All of the Above Radio. It's the best way to spend your weekends, y'all. Don't you miss it. And away we grow.
Hi, this is Lisa Gay Hamilton, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, the voice of mass dissent in Southern California.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Joined today by Lo Sontag, who's a journalist and a feminist urban theorist. She's been a past host and contributor to Feminist Magazine, and we're really happy to be talking to you today. So I think we have to start with the question, how are you this week?
Oh my goodness, I feel like, you know, deja vu. I feel like we've been here before. I'm a bit numb. I'm furious, but my fury always seems to manifest itself in action, which I'm very so happy about that. I mean, the thing is that when the election results were kind of known, my friends and I, you know, my friends in feminism and urbanism, we all kind of like, we need to come together at this time. We need to not fracture into little bitty groups. And let's use this opportunity like we use all opportunities. Has things turned out the way we wanted for the election? Regardless what would happen, we have to work together. This just essentially puts the urgency on it even more, that we need to come together as we did in 2016. but at least now we know what he's capable of. And I continue to go into work, my day job as a instructor at a small community college, talking about political economy and urbanism. And they're like, how do you feel? And I was like, how do you all feel? You know, and I thought that was wonderful. People kept asking me how I feel, because I think we are all, you know, how do you feel? Like, I want to know, how do you feel, Lynn?
I mean, same as you, like, absolute shock. And as my therapist would say, where do you feel it in your body? This, you know, feeling of dread, like a heavy tightness in your stomach, right? And then I also just started reaching out to people. It seemed to me like the thing to do was connect, right? And mm-hmm. I'm definitely listening to a lot of organizers and activists who've been doing the work all along, who didn't like stop doing their liberation work or their connecting work around specific issues. And there's like several online panels coming together that you sign up for all the webinars, you get the recordings. I'm just listening to a lot of people right now. It feels like it's just one of those moments where we also have to look back at our ancestral activists, so to speak, and be like, what did our feminist, our trans, our POC, you know, queer, all of our ancestors do like in the 70s? I feel like this is mm-hmm. that time again. And what can we learn from them? Also, like looking at, you know, what they did wrong. We should be aware of those lessons. But there's a lot to learn because they were dealing, I think, with this huge disaster of like the Vietnam War and Nixon, many parallels, except we're a little worse off now in a lot of ways.
No, we are definitely worst off. I mean, the thing is that I was on the train. I was kind of listening to this Howard Zinn, his book about you can't be neutral on a moving train.
Right.
And he's talking about the 1950s, and him teaching at Spelman College, and you know the time when people you know had to stand up. And then I'm thinking about the Black feminist of the Combahee River Collective, Demetia Fraser and Barbara Smith, and you know Bell Hooks. You know, she recently passed, and Patricia Hill Collins. And I'm just looking to them in regards to feminist work, Black feminist work, solidarity work, and I'm also really also trying to look at people who are still here. You know, a lot of times we look back to people who are no longer with us, which are, you know, great, great. But I'm like, who's doing the work now? Who can I connect to now? Who was there in the 70s and I can talk to? Who was there in the 80s that I could talk to? Who was there in the 90s that I can talk to now? I think about last Friday, I actually went to Feminist Friday virtually, Nicole Hebron. She's an artist. And I went to that, and I got so much information, so much like sisterhood. I miss the feminism in Los Angeles so much. And I thought, oh, maybe I was just having these rose-colored glasses. But as we were all talking about the election, and we realized the problem was the patriarchy and white supremacy, it wasn't anything like, oh, that she did wrong. We all kind of got on the same page. And I felt like, wow, this is great. I'm not wrong. LA feminists are amazing. But I mean, I really, that kind of catching that spirit, and that even in this horrible time, that optimism that we hold on the West Coast, I hope to bring that, because we got a lot of this from the East Coast, from New York, from New Jersey. This is where we kind of, these are the people where we got our theory from. Our theory that informs our practice. It's from the East Coast, and I want to actually like bring them back. Like, oh, here are your mothers, here are your sisters, here are your people that you know we were so enthusiastic by, and you can have these back too. Let's reinvigorate this feminist movement, and let's be better this time. Let's be, you know, anti-racist. Let's be like in regards to let's include trans women. Let's include seniors. Let's include young people, middle-aged people. Let's also include single women, married women. I think about historically excluded groups, and we talk about mothers a lot, which are so important because, you know, most of us had mothers, but we don't really talk about the fact about single women and women who are not married and what happens to them, especially now. What happens when essentially, you know, they're going to, you know, possibly the rights of people, same-sex couples being married are under threat. What happens to people? What happens to women who they feel are not important because essentially they can't reproduce children and they're not taking care of children? So what happens at this point? I never thought of single women as a historically excluded group, but now I do. I think it's a marginalized group, especially as women get older. You know, I've watched, you know, Black older women. I've watched you know, white lesbians. I've watched people whose spouses passed away, but their spouses did not have that much money. And essentially what happens to that person in our urban environment? And it's kind of frightening. It kind of scared me. I was like, oh my gosh, that could happen to you. Like, if you don't have a man, this is what will happen to you.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that I just remember getting conscious of that years ago when I was first starting with Feminist Magazine. And there was, I think it was from Making Contact, a special about homelessness in the San Francisco area. And then the figure that jumped out was women over 50 were the fastest growing group of homeless women in the Bay Area. And it suddenly hit me. It's exactly what you're talking about. And it was across race. And it was just about, it was about economics and, you know, mm-hmm. stability and not having a community. So just being cast aside. But let's come around to why we were originally going to talk today before the election results, which was your new project. And you've talked a little bit already about how you got inspired in terms of you've moved to New Jersey and you're deeply missing the LA feminist community. But talk about what you sort of discovered in New Jersey, what you had hoped for and what you discovered.
I think what I had hoped for in New Jersey, or just what I assumed, I thought a lot of things in regards to assuming everywhere is like Los Angeles. Ah. I had assumed that there would be feminists there. I just assumed it would be a very liberating place. It, I thought it would be like Los Angeles with snow and a better public transit system. And it was very not like that at all. I found a lot of oppression. I found a lot of scared women. Even kind of slightly going back, slightly back and forth to the election. And now, I don't think if I was not, when I was in Los Angeles, I would ever think that someone would vote just away because of their husband. But now, being in New Jersey, I know that's completely possible. I see women living in fear. They're living with fascist races. They're like, oh, I can't do that because my husband. I'm like, what year is this? It's 2024. And these are women with, you know, seven sister degrees, Ivy League diplomas. They seem completely normal. But because there's not that community here, there's such this focus on you're a mother, you're a wife. And that's great if that's what you want to do. But if your marriage doesn't work out or you don't want to do that, then all of a sudden you will be on the street. And I think this is something that I saw. I mean, this idea that if you were not a mother, if you were not a person that could reproduce laborers or create, you know, recreate hegemonies, ruling class, you are no longer worth being your life is not even worth anything. In regards to how they slowly take away your life here is by not living. You have a place to live, not, you know, not hiring you. Also something I saw too was high unemployment or underemployment of women simply because they were women. And this is across cultural lines, white women, black women, Asian American women, Latino women. If they decided to step outside the, you know, they did not get a job when they were raising their children, they can't get a job now. And it is really disheartening and scary to watch. And here's the thing. I don't want to say that I built this out of just fear, but just, I feel like this place is a wonderful place. You have a lot of great schools. It's beautiful. It's called the Garden State. You have so many smart people. I've met so many smart people out here in regards to just well-read, have really amazing ideas and thoughts and super creative. Like, we can reimagine something so amazing, and we have so much power. There's actually so many people here. New Jersey is the densest state. Mm-hmm. Just throwing out fact, it's the densest state in the United States.
Really?
So we have, yes. And wow. It is also the most urban state in the United States. Every single county in New Jersey is urban. So in a way, you have this weird thing because urban means two, it has two meanings, you know. You have urban, which means city and the built environment, but then you have urbanism that means like, oh, that means like black, inner city. So you have this weird thing. So when I talk about urbanism here, people also go, you know, oh no, we're not an urban area. I'm like, but you are. Uh-huh. And it's kind of like, and kind of like with the whole, like, I'm not an oppressed woman, but you are. I mean, it's very interesting to kind of watch from the outside, but also too, I guess, I can't remember her name, Boggs.
Grace Lee Boggs.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Grace Lee Boggs. She was talking about reimagining. Don't just think about dismantling. Think about reimagining. If we had this place, what would we be? I don't want a city where, okay, my goal is to not be homeless. Like, that's not the dream that I want to have. I want to have that. I want the right to sleep on the park bench when I'm homeless. This is not what I think, you know, we want to be striving for. But the machine, the monster, patriarchy, they've got us like afraid. So we're always like, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid. And so you're like, you just want to be somewhere where you're not afraid, but that's not being alive. So I want us, you know, like a feminist newsletter in New Jersey, I want it to be about creating this great city that we want to live in, one that's not market-centric, one that is centered on human beings, one in which everyone has space, one in which our differences and our experiences and our history are bridges and not walls. There's such an abundance in the collective. We have so much. We just need to really, like, plan, you know, actually be conscious and plan and organize, but in a way that's a goal that is not about fear and it's not about maintaining the status quo, but about creating the wonderful community that we are more than capable of creating, despite of all of the horrible things that have been happening.
Right. Well, I think that's really key what you just said, because you talk about in your first issue of A Feminist Newsletter in New Jersey, which is already up now online, you talk about you were inspired by the 2017 Women's March. And I remember so much that the theme of that, in fact, I think it's still part of the introduction of our show, is like, we're going to resist and engage. The theme was always like resistance. And, you know, some of that worked, but I think we got lost in thinking that marching and resisting was like the main, I won't say all of us, but, you know, majority, that was the main thing to be done, to do. And what you're talking about is, yes, like being aware and holding boundaries against the things that are going to happen. But more than that, visioning, right? Like somebody mm-hmm. like Grace Lee Boggs, so many others, you know, Octavia Butler, so many talk about visioning and actually instead of the sort of the passivity in a way of resistance, but the active. What do we want instead? So I think that seems to be a theme that you're on as well, right?
Yes, I mean, definitely. I mean, the thing is that we want to have, you know, essentially we want to build a future, right. build a future that we all want to be part of. I think that resisting is, you know, it's an important, you know, part of that. But I think that as somewhere along the line, when say we all got free, What will we be doing? What will we be doing when we all got free? Mm-hmm. Like, let's vision that. Let's imagine that. Let's imagine, like, what if we could do if we could all get along? What if we could do if we all cooperate? What if we could do if we all gave people a little bit of grace? In regards to, we're talking something out. We're working things out. Let's all assume that everyone's coming from a good place. People are like, well, then how do you know? Well, most people are coming from a good place. This assumption that I think about economics, they talk about the economics man, the man that's just trying to get the most out of whatever he wants. That person is not real. And we've been around, humans have been around for millions of years. If we had acted the way we've been acting the last 3% of the time that we've been on this planet, we wouldn't be alive this long. So it's totally capable for us to be wonderful, caring, helpful people. We just have to believe that, and we have to plan for it. And also, we have to talk about it. We have to talk about what we're building. We have to talk about what we want our city to look like. You know, I think about the book by Leslie Kern, Feminist City. And she was talking about what she wanted, you know, what a city that was built through a feminist lens would look like and who we would keep in our vision when we were creating, like, whether it be the buses, whether it be the schools, whether it be how we create our housing, how we value you know, how we value work inside the home and outside the home, how we value our childcare workers, how we value our media makers. I mean, that, and I think, you know, also something we should really learn or take away from Tuesday is that media is so important to create, whether it's, you know, whatever political sphere you're in, if you don't have a media, because that's what people do. Think about it. When you're not at work or you're not asleep, we're on social media. We're consuming news, but we've always done that. We've always done that. This is not new. We've always read the newspaper. We've always watched TV. We have to view that, our media, whether, you know, whether it's Feminist Magazine or Feminist Newsletter in New Jersey, as an important part of the project of liberation. It's because you march, okay, it's just the people that saw you there. But for media, it's forever. It's forever. You can, people, so many people can access it. And because I've done print newspapers, and I was kind of amazed at like how much traction. Like I remember I was printing out 2,000 papers, and then you print out 2,000 papers every week. And essentially maybe a pass. So you get maybe 6,000, 7,000 eyes because paper passed like 3 or 4 times. Think about, you know, what you could do with media, and how many eyeballs I could get 2,000 people in a day. I mean, you know, I can get 10,000 people in a month, but I mean, more than that. But I mean, if we actually kind of came together as media makers and created some kind of distribution system, that would be amazing, even though I'm going slightly off topic. But I'm just saying, it's like, this is part of urbanism. This is part of us communicating ideas and thoughts rather than, you know, us always. I think we're in this area now where we have all kind of succumbed to the conversation of the right, which is they want you to be afraid. They want you to think about safety. Even when we're talking about liberation, it's always about safety, 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 safety. I've tried so hard to not use the word safety because it's used in such a weaponized fashion now. And I want to be happy. And that would just already, I wouldn't have to say that. Like, to me, I feel like safety is something that you shouldn't even have to say. It's such a low, low bar for liberation. To me, I didn't get that bar is too low. I'm too wonderful to just be safe. I want to be happy. I want to be lively. I want to, you know, I want, that's the kind of city that I want. And I want a happy city. I want a city that I feel like I can be around. I can be on, like, essentially, if you're disabled, if you're senior, if you're a woman, regardless of your ethnic background, regardless of your class, if you can go out in a city and just kind of like, oh, I'm a little bit bored today. Let me just hang out on the, you know, hang out and people watch. And you feel okay doing that. You feel that I can just hang out here and sit here. That right there, that creating that is going to create safety. Rather than working towards the safety, working on the environment that you wouldn't have to even think about that. And I think that that's another great thing that we could do with like feminist urbanism. Kind of take that whole military complex visioning outside, out of our cities. You know, this is kind of how we get up with cop cities, because if you talk about fear, scare, what are you going to do? That's the language that you learn. You're also, keep in mind, we're teaching young people this language. We're teaching young feminists this language. If how we speak, they're going to speak in like 30, 40 years. So you got to think about like, oh, I don't know if I want people saying this 40 years from now, like, let's be safe. That'd be kind of creepy.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right. Safety is like the most low bar ever. But also, it kind of connects to like dividing people and isolating people. And then also that whole thing of sort of the individualism, right? And when in fact there's like more than safety, there's like enrichment and connection and all these things in like being connected to each other and working together. So you talk a bit about that. I should just repeat for our listeners that we're talking to Lo Sontag, who's just created a new media project, which is called A Feminist Newsletter in New Jersey. And Lo, tell us, so you talk a little bit about this sort of what you hope for from the newsletter, like how you hope to connect people and connect feminists of all genders, of all kinds in New Jersey, right?
Yes. No, it's definitely. I made a point to not, because I think one of the things I was trying to do when I kind of came here, I'm looking for feminists, and people kept saying, well, we have women's organizations. And I was like, this is not the same. Feminism is a political lens to view society through, and it could be urbanism, it could be education, it could be a variety, it could be art. But this is different. This is not the same thing as women. I'm not a biological essentialist. I think it's kind of a disgusting thing concept. Really, I am a person that, you know, if you're a man, if you're a woman, you know, regardless, this is. But I want us to be one group. Like I want us to be one big tent, as they call it. I feel that in some ways people kind of, the Cohombi River Collective, I don't think they really heeded their messages. They were talking about Patricia and a lot of these black feminists, they were saying, yes, we're talking about, you know, black women, but we are saying this is for everyone. This is a bridge, not a solidarity where we would have like just black women in the room,
right?
Just Latinas in the room, just lesbians in the room. We want a room. I want a room, a tent that includes everyone, because how are we going to get anything accomplished in all of these various different silos? We literally cannot. And also, it's going to benefit everyone. I think that feminist urbanism can benefit. I don't see how it wouldn't benefit. It would even benefit men. It would even benefit men, because we're all working together. We're all creating a society that no one has to fail in. This whole competition, it doesn't have to be that way. We can create a cooperative society. We could create cooperative group living situations that are nice. I'm not talking about living rough. I can't stand that. Don't worry, I'm not going to a farm. If you like farming, that's fine, but that's just not me. But we can have a nice apartment complex that's a co-op. It could be beautiful.
Right.
We can have co-op stores. We can have co-op art galleries. I'm pretty sure that they do. You know, we don't have to always have everything be market-based. And I feel that this is something, you know, space is a mean of production, to use Henry Lefebvre, which is another person that I'm inspired from. This project inspired me with, in regards to his work on urbanism and space and people having a right to the city. And, you know, I think we're losing that. We're losing this right to the city because we feel that the city is just for the wealthy or just for a certain kind of people. But keep in mind, with the climate crisis, this is not a choice. The urban environment, urbanism, that is the most that's going to save us. It's going to save the planet. We can't have this sprawl. We can't have people living out in the desert and then commuting back to Los Angeles or in New Jersey. We can't have people living in like PA, Pennsylvania, and then coming into Manhattan to work because they can't afford to live in the city. This is ridiculous. This is not just about, oh, we are getting together and being happy and friends. This is also about the climate. This is also about the climate crisis. Urbanism is an effective way to deal with the climate crisis. And if we want to continue, you know, on our path of solving this problem, we need to find a way that we can live together closer. And that's in a figurative way and a literal way. And because this is no longer a choice, like, well, I don't really want to live there. You can't live out in the middle of nowhere anymore. We don't have the resources. We're not going to have the ability to take care of you. We're not going to have the ability to send an ambulance out there. Also, you know, how are you going to get there? The gas prices, the runoff to the lakes. The more we have these incidents in regards to weather, the more we're seeing that, wow, if we're closer together, this is going to be a lot easier to handle and deal with.
Right. All of the wildfires, it's always all of the resources are going to like save individual homes. You know, people who are living in areas that are wild areas. And yeah, I mean, never mind the impact on, you know, the animal life and all of that. But let's come back to the newsletter quickly. We're running out of a little bit of time here to tell us where people can see it, where they can read it, and how they can get connected and involved.
Well, how you would read it is you would go to a feminist newsletter in newjersey.com. I know that sounds weird, but it's literally just a feminist newsletter in newjersey.com. You can, at that point, you can sign up to the mailing list. And at that point, you can sign up to the mailing list. And let me do this really quick. I'm trying to look to see what were you have to become a member. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that we have free memberships, so you can join for free. But we're also having a membership drive where we're trying to get 1,920 feminists by January 6th, $9 a month. And we think we can do it. All you have to do is $9 a month. We're trying to get 1,920 feminists to be part of that. So you could either join the mailing list free, pay $9 a month, or you could pay $19.11 in honor of the first International Women's Day. So yeah, so I have a little thing. So $9 for Title IX, the $19.11 is for $19.11. It's for the first International Women's Day. And 1,920 is when white women got the right to vote. Even though it wasn't every woman in the United States did not get a chance to vote, but still, if white women hadn't gotten a chance to vote, when we wouldn't, you know, we that's how we marched forward. You know, sometimes we want to do things in a different way, but that's what it was. And that's still a significant date in our history.
Right, exactly. Well, so I am looking forward. I'm going to go off and become one of your subscribers. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation, and completely agree with you that media is part of our liberation struggle, because we get to like spread the ideas and connect people and like share information. So all of that is so vital. And have a conversation. And I know that you love to have conversations, so here we are. we've been talking to Lo Sontag and hearing about a feminist newsletter in New Jersey. And we will also have links to that on our website as soon as this interview airs. Thank you so much, Lo, for joining us this morning.
And thank you so much for Lynn, because, you know, you are one of my inspirations. The fact that you kind of keep going and you always have such a professional, like sophisticated feminist magazine. You're like literally like my kind of my guide. Like, okay, I want to be as good as that. Like,
wow.
I want to be able to reach people and be consistent. And so you do really great work. So thank you for all the work that you continue to do for so long, such a long time.
Wow, thank you. I'm really touched. And yeah, I'm always happy when there's like more. So I love that this has started. Thank you so much. Okay. We've been talking to Lo Sontag and hearing about a feminist newsletter in New Jersey. The power.
Support comes from the Luckman Fine Arts Complex, presenting the UK's preeminent gospel ensemble, the Kingdom Choir, Saturday, November 16th at 8 p.m. Known for their acclaimed performance at the Royal Wedding, the Kingdom Choir brings their joyous spirit to the Luckman in their new holiday show, A Kingdom Christmas. For more information, visit luckman.org and kpfk.org. When I think of you.
This is Donna Walker, host of Pacifica Performance Showcase, airing on Friday afternoons from 2:30 to 3 p.m. right here on KPFK. Covering film, theater, music, and literature, it's arts and culture to enlighten, enliven, and educate. Right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
After decades of restrictions to abortion across this country, people continue to find ways to make this vital procedure safer, more affordable, and more accessible. Remember what women have done in the past when abortion was illegal. And check in on today's movement facilitating abortions that are self-managed at home. We're not giving out medical or legal advice in this program. Instead, we're sharing an important history and new developments in abortion options. First, we bring you our adaptation of a piece by Hannah Nguyen and State of the Human. It's a look back at the Jane Collective of 1970s in Chicago, told by the Janes themselves. Officially known as the Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation, these women offered safe, affordable, and friendly abortions when the practice was still illegal, and the alternatives were much more dangerous than today.
It was just like a powder keg. It was ready to go off.
We were so foolish that we weren't even afraid of getting caught.
I was 20 years old. I was really a kid. I was scared to death. We all were. We were all scared. None of us wanted to go to jail.
If we're at risk, we're all at risk.
May 3rd, 1972, in fact, the Chicago police from a precinct that we did not work in busted us. There were women screaming. There were women yelling. They asked us, "What are you in for?" And we said, "Abortion." And they said, "Ooh."
We'll hear arguments in number 18, Roe against Wade.
In the absence of abortion or legal, medically safe abortions, women often resort to the illegal abortion. And in fact, if the woman is unable to get either a legal abortion or an illegal abortion in our state, she can do a self-abortion, which is certainly, perhaps, by far the most dangerous.
It isn't about population, it isn't about fetuses, it isn't about any of that stuff. It is really about controlling women.
I'm Judith Arcana. I'm a writer, a teacher, and of course, I'm a Jane. I got involved because in the summer of that year, 1970, I thought I was pregnant. I knew that at that time in my life, having a child would be terrible for the child and not good for me either. And so I thought, okay, I'll have to get an abortion. And one of the people that I thought of to ask was a medical student in Chicago. So I called him up. He said, "Everybody here says, call this number and ask for Jane." I called the number. A woman called me back. She said her name was Jane. Turns out, of course, it wasn't. Everybody said that. Soon I was one of the people saying that on the phone. As it happened, I was not pregnant. And so I called her back to say that I wouldn't need an abortion that time. And she said, "We're taking in new people in the fall, and it sounds like you might be interested." Yes, as a matter of fact, I think I am.
I really felt that abortion rights were the front line of women's rights because women were literally dying. Jean Gallitzer Levy. I'm 66 years old. When I was 20, I was a member of the Abortion Counseling Service. Women were dying from back alley abortions, but they were also dying because they were denied basic medical services that should have been available. Women would go to the hospital with natural miscarriage. And because there was such a stigma to abortion, they would be turned away. Women died of miscarriage during this period. We were a varied group. There were young housewives, people who were older, college students. Everybody coming into the service was trained as a counselor. And you would pick a woman, you would call her, you would set up a time for her to come over, give her a cup of tea, you know, like you would host anyone. And then we would explain what the procedure was. It was enormously empowering. What would happen, you know, this woman would come in, she had this terrible problem, which had the potential to make a complete mess of her life. You know, what she saw in front of her was disaster. And in 20 minutes, that was gone. That mess, that disaster that was sitting right here in her life was gone. And her life was in front of her. It was enormously empowering. And for many, many women in the service, it was the first time they'd really taken control of their lives. It just felt great.
Abortion Counseling Service was a context in which to put my ideas about how society should be. So yes, of course it was a politicizing situation. No two ways about it.
My name is Martha Scott. I live in Chicago and have lived here many, many years.
I was a counselor at the Abortion Counseling Service when I had my first abortion. And then much later on, I had an abortion again, and that was done by a woman I knew.
Yeah.
It should be just a normal possibility. It's not what you necessarily choose first, but if, in fact, it's what you need, it's what you need. When you see yourself as a person who is extended around a family, then if you do political work, then you see yourself as a person extended around a much larger entity, or you're living in a way that maybe makes a difference to the world. That changes you. We were pretty ordinary people, smart, competent, whatever, but pretty ordinary. And we did a very extraordinary thing. And we did this extraordinary thing because we had a goal and a vision and a group.
By the turn of the year was when we also began to learn medical practice.
Started to lean on our guy. Teach us, teach us, teach us. And little things started to happen. He would let us come in to assist, which really meant in the beginning, sit there beside the bed, because it was in somebody's apartment. You know, there was no operating table. Sit down, hold her hand, stroke her brow, give her some water to drink, whatever, you know, to be comforting. The first time I was allowed to come in blew my mind. It was constant. We did this every week, several days a week. Dozens of women came on those days for abortions. That's what had to get done.
I was absolutely drawn to it. Like I said, I walked in, I saw it, I thought, whoa, this is the real deal. Look at this. And also, I think there was an element of learning to do and be competent at something that was important and valuable in women's lives. Of course, now we are practicing medicine without a license. Because, of course, when abortion is illegal, it's not medicine. Actually, what it is felony homicide, which is very scary. May 3rd, 1972, in fact, the Chicago police from a precinct that we did not work in busted us.
So I was working the front. I was sitting and talking to a woman who was very nervous. She had come with her sister. It turned out that she was the person who had turned us in. I really resent that. Later, I heard a knock at the door. So I went down the corridor and opened the door. And there were the two tallest men I'd ever seen in my life. And all I remember is seeing them. And then I turned around and I walked down the corridor in front of them. Without saying anything to them, I got into the room and I said, "These are the police. You do not have to say anything." They were furious and they arrested me.
If I thought I knew how the system worked, now I knew how the system worked. At this point, I'm
28 or 29 years old. I'm married. I have a tiny child. I've been arrested. My dad says, you know, your mother had an abortion. And I was just blown away, not because she did, but because I said, no, Dad, I didn't know that. Nobody ever mentioned that. And of course, I mean, if she had lived and if she had been the mother who raised me, she may very well have talked to me about it. I'll never know. So my dad told me the story of my mother's abortion. I loved it. I mean, I don't wish unwanted pregnancy on anyone. Never in a million years would I. However, I loved the fact that this work that I was doing could have been. I can't believe I feel all these years later, but it still makes me choke. I could have been of use to my mother, my own mother, who was so young. Law and justice are not the same thing. There are many unjust laws. There always have been, there always will be. So I am not one who respects the law. The service was an enormous influence on my development as a human, and certainly, of course, as a woman.
Being a mother is really important to me. I wanted to be a mother, and I was, but I got to choose when, and I got to choose how. As a result, I was able to have the children I wanted and raise them the way I wanted to.
You, as someone who doesn't believe in this, have really no reason to tell me, who does feel it's appropriate, that I can't do it. You have your own choices. Those are legitimate choices. Good luck to you, should you be pregnant for the fourth time or tenth time and you don't want to have that baby. Your point of view does not impinge on, should not impinge on mine. And I'm not telling you to have an abortion, and you shouldn't be telling me not to.
I think that January 22nd, 1973 would be an historic day.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy...
We thought, well, this is a battle we've won. Well, of course, it's absolutely not true.
In this instance, the Supreme Court has withdrawn protection for the human rights of unborn children.
It's unbelievable. I would not have expected this. I thought we had gotten past it.
The House is moving forward with a plan to ban abortions after 20 weeks.
I would not have expected this, the assault that's going on women's health care. And we're looking at an assault on birth control, on basic preventative care, on health care for anybody who can't sort of circumvent repression.
You know, I've been participating in the March for Life for years, and there's one thing that had always struck me, and that is the vigor and the enthusiasm of the pro-life movement.
It isn't about population, it isn't about fetuses, it isn't about any of that stuff. It is really about controlling women. The fewer options women have, the less control they have. Women who have control are kind of threatening to the people who make these decisions, I guess. I mean, nobody wants to give up their power.
I don't see women sitting down and saying, okay, do what you want. I think women are going to be the backbone of the resistance. This is a generation of women who were consciously told they could do anything, they could have anything, they were human beings. And then in every kind of subtle and not so subtle undercurrent, they were told the opposite. I think we're sitting on another powder keg.
The Jane Collective performed approximately 11,000 abortions. They were arrested by the police one time in 1972. But their case was dismissed after the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court judgment made abortion legal throughout the United States on January 22, 1973. When people use phrases like, on their own terms or outside of a clinic. They're referring to self-managing abortions. Unfortunately, most of the general public are not aware of the option of self-managed abortions. There are a variety of methods for self-managing, most of which are safe and reliable, often just using simple herbs or medicines. Many advocates say the focus needs to be on decriminalizing those options for all people, whether there's a clinic accessible or not.
People will end their abortions outside of clinics, and helping them do so safely or as safely as possible is part of the way that providers think about what they're doing. So self-induced abortion is explicitly illegal in Arizona and six other states: Delaware, Idaho, Nevada, New York, Oklahoma, and South Carolina.
So those are the states where self-managed abortion is explicitly illegal. But people have been arrested in other states where conservative prosecutors can charge people with the unlawful practice of medicine or use so-called feticide laws to prosecute people who have or assist with self-managed abortions.
So even if there's a state that doesn't explicitly ban self-induced abortion, because prosecutors have their own personal beliefs about abortion, they're increasingly using things that might not seem like they connect as charges to prosecute people. But there are many different ways that prosecutors can and have investigated and brought charges against and incarcerated people for self-induced abortion. This great organization in the Bay Area called the SIA Legal Team has identified 40 different types of laws that could be used to prosecute someone for self-induced abortion or for helping someone end their own pregnancy. They really vary. So there's procuring a miscarriage, which sounds very arcane, but is still illegal in some places. People have been investigated and prosecuted for failing to report a death to the coroner, for misusing fetal remains. Prosecutors sort of throw charges at the wall to see what sticks, like pasta. Over the last 8 years, since the 2010 midterms, there have been sort of a record number of anti-abortion legislation passed across the country. Hundreds of laws have been introduced, and many of them passed. And they've really run the gamut in the ways in which they restrict abortion. But, you know, they either limit when you can get an abortion, or they make it harder for providers of abortion to do their jobs by requiring that they, you know, have hallways a certain width, or that they meet with their clients or patients several times before offering the abortion. Trump's election sort of solidified this idea that access to abortion in clinics was sort of had reached its peak and was going to decrease, access would decrease going forward. And one of the promises that Trump made during his campaign was that he would actually overturn Roe v. Wade and would basically make getting abortions illegal. So what does abortion look like when it's no longer legal, and also when it's effectively not legal and available because of these restrictions?
If abortion becomes illegal, more people will probably turn to in-home abortions. Fortunately, self-managed methods have improved greatly over the past decades. And now, as in the past, there's a growing movement of brave folks building a network to share knowledge and support.
When we look at the underground abortion movement on a worldwide level, what we see is women rising to the needs of anyone that desires reproductive freedom. When you have a pregnancy and you cannot handle that and you need to terminate it, you need to be able to do that. The reason that right now there's more action is because people don't trust the state. We have so much legislation. What we just saw in Texas with the closure of abortion centers, we see an onslaught of hatred and anti-abortion legislation that has been exceedingly positive for them. We are not winning. The reason women are gathering is because we've been losing ground. I think it's very important as a feminist revolutionary that we recognize that we are living in fascist times, and that it has always been so that we have been under control as women, or trying to be under control. But I have to say that we live in one nation under surveillance, and that it's very important that we proceed carefully, cautiously, and recognize that we must step forward. This is not the time for passivity. The earth depends on us taking action and making a stand. If you're sitting on the fence right now, you really just have a stick up your ass. You've got to make a decision and take a step. And learning about your body and taking responsibility for yourself, for your reproductive health, that is revolutionary. So welcome to the team, because the world needs you, and we need knowledge to be shared, not controlled.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine, and thanks to all of the contributors today. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Susan Dehim's Whispers from the Underworld on November the 17th at the Nimoy. Known for her innovation and striking vocal capabilities, Dehim presents an evening that highlights her original compositions for film, visual arts, and operatic pieces. More info and tickets at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Chimurenga. Join us at the Liberated Zone of Freedom Now every Saturday from 11 to noon for a Pan-African perspective on world affairs in a fly music mix. And as always, we stand ready for the revolution.
Donate your used car, truck, or boat to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. It's an easy way to help support KPFK and receive a tax deduction. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. An operator will arrange a good time to pick up your vehicle. 877-KPFK-AUTO, or go online to kpfk.org.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission. Yeah.